Church will serve it.
Pandemonium. What a call there from the 1996 Olympic Games, the inaugural Olympic Games that included beach volleyball, which was, of course, won by Karch Kirai, and the reference to the pink hat that he wore, and it was his signature throughout his illustrious career, and his partner, Kent Steffes, who also won alongside with him. And here's what I love about beach volleyball. So Michael Jordan refuses to give out interviews to Sports Illustrated, which is the top sports magazine on the planet. Tiger Woods hasn't given a candid interview in what seems like a couple decades, and yet Karch Kirai, the guy who won the FIVB Player of the Century, who's known unanimously as the greatest player in beach volleyball history, offered more than an hour of his time to sit down and talk with me, you know, some 20-something-year-old journalist who's just working on a beach volleyball book, and he was awesome. You know, over the next hour, as you'll see, we'll talk about everything from the Olympic Games in 96 to the AVP's formation in 83 and 84, and the strike that they had to go through to form the AVP Tour. We'll talk about all of his many 148 wins, his various partners. The guy was incredible. I spent about 15 minutes at the American Sports Center, which is his home base, where he is the coach of the U.S. Women's National Team, and he helped them win a bronze medal at the past Olympic Games. So he has now been involved as an indoor gold medalist, as a player twice, as a beach gold medalist one time, and now as a coach. The guy has done it all. So be sure to listen in. It is a great, great interview with Karch. I didn't do anything. I just asked him questions and let the guy talk. And if you are a coach, an athlete, a fan of sports, I highly encourage you to listen. Some more good news. We also have an additional sponsor for the podcast. It is Mobile Beach Coach by Andrew Dentler. If you want to get your videos analyzed by the pros, go to mobilebeachcoach.com and hit him up. I promise you it will be worth your time. But for now, enjoy Karch Kirai's interview. And again, I highly encourage you to listen. I rewatched the Atlanta Olympics, your couple matches in that, and at least the ones that are left on YouTube, so just quarters, semis, and the finals. And was there really that much animosity between you and Sinjin, or were the announcers blowing that up a little bit?
I think there was a sense of frustration. I don't know if it's so much animosity, although sometimes that would boil. You know, it was more like rivalry and frustration that a team we had. It was a rare time when there were Olympic trials, but we had a team that was. We felt like at that time we had the best beach volleyball teams and players in the world. The Americans, as the world was just starting to learn this game, starting to catch up. And so we had so many good teams and players like Scott Akitubi and Brian Lewis and Randy Stoklos and Adam Johnson. And so for a team to be exempt from that trials process and not have to face all those really good teams, we were quite frustrated with that. We wanted to have the best representation possible. We wanted to try and sweep the medals because we had good enough players and teams capable of doing that.
And
then we had another team that was exempt from most of the process of trials and qualification, exempt from the early process that happened on a Wednesday and Thursday, or Tuesday and Wednesday. This was all in Baltimore. The team of Carlos Briseño and Jeff Williams was exempted or granted a berth straight to the Final Four, where then they, we were confident that there were teams far better than they were. With our hope being, let's send our strongest contingent to the first ever beach volleyball Olympic Games. As it turns out, Sinjin and Carl played a great tournament, and they were better than we were giving them credit for. It still doesn't tell me whether they would have qualified had they been required to do so.
And volleyball had been around, beach volleyball had been around for a long time before the Olympics. Was getting it into the Olympics sort of a vindicating moment that this sport's about to become, you know, a worldwide phenomenon almost? Because now that we've seen it, you know, Brazil has fallen in love with it. It's big in the Netherlands, in Germany too. So yeah. It's really spread since then. I don't know if the impact in America has really been felt as much as it's been around the world.
No, and that's where I got to give somebody like Sinjin a lot of credit, because we were focused on our American tour and on our American game. And so we had very little to do with doing the work of trying to sell the International Federation that this is a good version, this would be a great discipline to add to the Olympics. We were excited when it got added, but I can't say that we did a lot of the work there. I think people like Sinjin did a lot more of the work. We had some concerns about, you know, what would be the costs of taking it internationally. Some of the costs were and resulted in some rule changes, where in 2001 the court got shrunk down, and the scoring system got changed, and so some of the rules have changed to seemingly make it a little more of a ex-indoor players, big man's game, where maybe a player like a Brian Lewis or an Adam Johnson, it's a little tougher for a player like that to thrive, which I think is, as I projected it out, would be sad that a player like a Sinjin would maybe, who's one of the all-time greats, would have less chance with these rules than with the rules that we all grew up with to excel. And you want to see a player like that excel. That's really good for the game. So So we had some qualms about the costs that would be involved in becoming a part of the Olympic movement. But overall, it's led to explosion. I think one of the big reasons is that a country like Switzerland can invest some serious resources in a couple of players and be a real medal threat. And they have been. They've won medals. If it's an indoor team, you've got to find, you know, 8, 10, 12 really good players. But if you're right, a smaller country, that's near impossible. But can you find two? Absolutely. Germany has never been, you know, at the top, like cutting edge, top five in the world with their indoor teams. They've been pretty darn good, but with their beach teams, their men have won a gold medal, their women now have won a gold medal, and so when you need only two components there, it's this incentive for teams around, countries around the world. Like, all we need is one good team. Yeah. All we need is two good players, and we can make a real impact at the Olympics.
Mm-hmm. And I know that you talk about the cost with the rules changes that were probably going to happen with the Olympics, and that rules changes were sort of the impetus to form the AVP Tour. And I know that the last straw seemed to be the switch to the Mikasa volleyball.
Yeah.
So what was it like as a player kind of forming the AVP Tour? I guess kind of take me through that whole process.
There were some different iterations of people. I think there was a company called, if I'm remembering right, first of all, I think the first tournament that most people's recollection of in Southern California was in 1949 or so in Ocean Beach in San Diego area. And then Manhattan Beach has been running for a really long time, since late 50s or 1960.
I think 60 was the first.
There was a real cult following, people like Gene Selznick, and bringing out a Hollywood actress or two and taking a photo and releasing that, and all of a sudden he was a brilliant promoter of the game and all the aspects that went along with it. Like, of course, why wouldn't you attract a lot of attention to have an attractive Hollywood actress in her bathing suit come out and join the show. So some things were really growing. And then a company, a good guy named Jack Butafish and Group Dynamics came in and started bringing in some money. I actually played in the first ever professional tournament, at least the first ever professional one in Southern California. It was held at Will Rogers State Beach. I think it was in 1970, it was either 76 or 77. I played with my high school volleyball coach, Rick Olmsted. And we, you know, we signed waivers so that I wouldn't take the money because if we had won any money, we didn't win any money, but if we had, I wanted to keep my eligibility and continue to play in high school and play in college because there was no scholastic beach volleyball at that time, even though that's now an exploding component, at least on the women's side for college and on boys and girls side for California high schools. But that was, so Group Dynamics was doing some really nice things, and the big season-ending event was the Redondo Beach, the Cuervo World Championships of Beach Volleyball. We called it World Championships, but there really weren't any. They even tried to find a couple of Brazilians to play, but the Brazilians were used to playing a very different game, a real throwball kind of game.
Yeah.
And so when they would come to our very strict overhead setting standards, they would get whistled time after time for a violation. So then they'd have to go to their second choice, which wasn't something they used a lot, which was a forearm set. And so they just weren't used to that kind of the game that we played here. And so the Cuervo, we called it the Cuervo, was really the crown jewel, and that had, that really developed a cult following. It was the season-ending event to go along with the great Manhattan Beach Open. And then there was a Manhattan 2, the natural light Manhattan Beach number 2, which would be late at each season. So there was actually a the original Manhattan and then a Manhattan 2. I think it was called Natural Light. I'm sure you could dig it up in arts books, but anyway, and then we would finish up with, in Redondo, there was a kind of a closed area there where people would even pay a little money to come in the gate to access this beach. So it was kind of the beginnings of an admission type situation. And the tournaments just went off. They were really fun to play in. I was still keeping my eligibility, so I think I won $375 in the 1978 Cuervo World Championships. Got third place with Don Shaw. Donated it all to the UCLA. I think that in itself was a violation. I don't think I was even allowed to designate where the money actually went, because I think that could technically have been a violation and maybe forced me to be declared a professional. What I was hoping to do is, I'm not going to take the money, I'll give it to the athletic department and maybe they could pay books for me in return or something. But I, of course, I didn't get that. I think I broke the rules just by telling the organizers to write that $375 check to the UCLA athletic department. And then went on to win with St. John in 79 and 81. And of course, while I still have my college eligibility, I think what some people would do is just have their partner accept all the money and then maybe get it back. I didn't want to mess with that. I really wanted to have, Ken Steffes actually had a problem and he lost some eligibility. I don't remember the specifics, but he started at Stanford, transferred to UCLA, and his plan was to play indoors, and something got messed up there. He played with Wally Martin,
His coach took the money.
Yeah, and something happened, and he lost his eligibility, and so that's why I was really glad to, besides the probable violation of designating where it should go, I was pretty clean on that, and I wanted to be able to play all 4 of my years of eligibility at UCLA.
And so, I mean, you started playing volleyball when you were 6, right?
Yeah.
And then your first tournament at 11. You know, yeah. You had your double, triple A when you were a teenager. You were All-American at UCLA all 4 years and going to win Olympic golds. How did you stay so humble in the process? Because, I mean, in the 15 minutes I was here, everyone was like, Carson, most humble guy. You know, and you're player of the century in FIVB. So how did you stay so humble and so driven along the way?
I guess the bottom line is I try to be a learner. I think the more I learn, the more I know that I realize that I don't know. And so if you're really committed to learning, you have to be open to it from anyone. I'm sitting here impressed with your research ability. You're telling me things that, unless you've worked pretty hard on research, that people wouldn't know. So you're doing some homework. I probably have something to learn from that. But if I have the humility to understand that whoever I come in contact with, I have something of huge value to learn from that person. That's going to help me do what one of my big goals is, and that's to improve and to get better. And there are thousands of people out there right now, and I don't know their stories. Someday maybe I get to learn, but if I had a little time to learn somebody's story, or going to any coaching clinic, I'm usually excited not to go as a presenter, but to go to learn and have conversations with people and exchange ideas. So I think it takes some humility to do that. I just know it helps me be a better learner if I take an approach with a little more humility. And so that's a big reason why I do it, because another reason is just it's the right thing to do, to treat people with respect. I think a great way to learn about somebody, and I care a lot about integrity and operating with character and doing the right thing and operating on a high ethical and moral level. A great way to learn, you know, if I were wanting to learn more about somebody I might think of as a possible friend, if you were wanting to learn about a woman, are you married?
No.
If you were wanting to learn about a woman who has the possibility of being somebody you could share your life with, a great way to do that is just to watch how that person treats people. Like when you go to a restaurant, you may never go back there. And so lots of times if people don't operate with humility, they might not treat the server at that restaurant with a high degree of respect, because they don't need anything from that person, and they probably will never need anything from that person. But that's the sign of somebody's really good character. And if you want a mirror onto somebody's character, it's important. A good way to do that is just to look at somebody's friends. Look at the people, not so much family, we don't have choice in family, but the people that you choose to most associate yourself with would be a good window on your ethical standards if I were to study those people. And so and how you would treat a server at a restaurant that you've never been to before. So those are a couple of big reasons why, that every human is, you know, created in God's image and deserves a great deal of respect. And so that it helps me do that better if I approach it with a little more humble attitude.
I like that. And you guys, as a collective group of beach volleyball players, kind of had to take a dose of humility in 1983 when you went on strike during the World Championships, which kind of a misnomer because it was American Championships. But how difficult was it to sit out, because I know that there was money in beach volleyball, and that was the biggest money tournament, but, you know, it wasn't like you were about to go buy a mansion, you know, in Malibu off the money that was happening. So how difficult was it to go on strike at that world championship?
It was really tough. If I look back on it now, you know, the company that was doing some really good work for us, some company names might have been Event Concepts, Group Dynamics. There were some nice things happening there, but we were young and brash and hot-headish, and I think we probably could have found, basically the company had built this kind of hot new cult professional sport. And I think we resented not having a little more voice in how, for example, making a decision. They were trying to professionalize the sport more and monetize the sport more, so they sold a sponsorship to Mikasa Volleyballs, and they came up with a very different product and didn't really solicit a lot of player feedback. Mm-hmm. And so I think they could have headed that off, but that's not to say that that company wasn't doing some really good promotional work and building interest in the sport.
Right.
And we kind of cut them off at the knees there. So I would definitely, if I look back at it, I would look at it and think, you know what, I think we could have been a little less hot-headed in our approach, and I think we would have been able to find some other solutions instead of having it get to the point of, as it kind of got nasty there with a strike.
Right.
With having a strike so early, within 5-6 years of the initiation of a new professional sport.
And then, well, when you guys took over, there really didn't seem to be a whole lot of growing pains, which is sort of surprising, because, I mean, with any new company, you'll notice that, you know, a startup isn't going to be making millions in the first year, but you guys, it seemed like you hit the ground running with it, with Leonard Armato running the scene. So how nice was it to have your own players association and having the choice over, say, your own volleyballs and your own rules?
It was nice in some ways and challenging in others, because the board, because of the structure of it, had to be made, had to consist of active players only. And active players, as a group, we didn't have savvy business experience on average. And so, you know, that exposed the sport to some, to a few challenges. For example, for a good number of years, the relationship was basically, this is the Miller Lite AVP Tour. So it tended to be highly dependent on Miller Lite. And so basically whatever, a lot of the costs, a lot of the expenses, a lot of the losses, it was just Miller Lite, you know, write a check at the end of the year to cover this so that the tour will it wasn't a tour that was creating, that was operating at a break even, or even better still, creating a profit. It was kind of, Miller will cover this and make it go. So the exposure was, if Miller has a Miller Brewing Company and the Miller Lite brand have a change of heart, which they did at the end of 1996, then things get really dicey. And they did. There was an implosion. And essentially the tour went bankrupt at that time. And Billy Berger and some other people involved in the sport just kind of kept it alive on sheer passion. And then Leonard Armato came back into the picture in 2001 and kind of brought it back on to NBC, but there were some real that was a business decision that probably in the late 80s, early 90s, mid 90s probably deserved more thought and scrutiny, because it was tremendously costly to be on NBC for an hour. It was a time buy, and you know, each of those hours might have been 200, 250, 300 grand. And so the tour was like, all right, well, we've got to feed the beast and continue to try to promote it. But that wasn't necessarily, I'm not saying it was wrong, but I don't know if we necessarily had the savvy to know what was the right number of hours to be buying, and at what point are we not getting enough bang for our buck spending, you know, close to $300 at $300,000 an hour on NBC, where it got up to, I think, something close to 15, 20 hours for a summer, which was a ton.
Yeah. And how much
and
of that?
And multiple tournaments. And then live events and timed games. That was a somewhat controversial thing to keep it within the hour time slot.
Mm-hmm.
Now they've figured out generally a different way to do it with two out of three rally scoring. Before it was play a game to 15 side out scoring, but the clock would run as the ball was in play.
Okay. We're going to interrupt the interview with Karch for a quick commercial break.
Check out mobilebeachcoach.com if you're interested in having your match footage analyzed by the pros.
And now back to the show. And how much of that, I don't want to, you know, point fingers or anything, but I know that Jeff Dankworth did a really good job, at least numbers-wise, when he was there. And then when Jerry Solomon took over, it seemed like that was when things started going downhill. And I know that, like you said, it wasn't really a sustainable practice to just have, okay, here's our bill, Miller Lite, can you cover us? But
yeah,
how much was that?
Yeah, I don't know for sure. I just don't know that the business was ever tracked to a standard like a publicly listed company mm-hmm. might have to say, it's my understanding that whether it was Jeff or Jerry or whoever, the tour was not on a break-even basis. It was kind of lucky that somebody like Miller Brewing was ready to pick up the tab at the end. And then when they stopped doing that, that became a huge challenge for the tour in at the end of 96 and then getting into 97 and the retrenchment that had to take place. And then there was another retrenchment, of course, much later
mm-hmm.
When I guess now Donald's son is has kind of taken over, but the tour again went through some tough times, I guess sometime after 2010.
And that will do it for part one of my interview with Karch Karai. Sorry I'm splitting it into two parts, but I'm trying to make the podcast a little bit more digestible, smaller bites. And plus, you know, I wanted to stretch out. I'll be honest, wanted to stretch out my interview with Karch as many as I could here without diluting it too much. So thanks again to Karch for taking so much time out of his day to talk to me about beach volleyball. And check in next week for part two of my interview with Karch Karai.